The Tom Woods Show, episode 545.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
This Christmas season, get cash back when you shop online using Ebates, which also pays you $100 if you refer just three people. Check it out through tomwoods.com/Ebates. Hey, everybody, it is Social Contract Day here on the show. You knew this day had to come at some point, and now here it is. I want to talk about this idea that you get thrown at you all the time, and that, of course, absolutely permeates modern political thought. And it is the suggestion that really, government is something we have consented to. It's not something being arbitrarily imposed on us by an arbitrary group of people, but to the contrary, it is something we have consented to. And because we've consented to it, a lot of libertarian complaints are thereby invalidated. That's the short version of the argument that we're going to hear from an awful lot of people. And you hear it from your friends, you hear it on Facebook, you hear it all over the place. You hear it from our critics. It's everywhere. So I thought it might be useful to say a little bit about it. But this is really your lucky day, not just because we're covering the social contract, but also because it's two episodes in one. I've talked about the social contract before, so I'm going to actually share with you a few minutes from a video that I did on it, and then I'm going to add my further commentary. But then, about halfway through the episode, I want to switch gears and talk about something else that people really liked that I wrote recently, and not everybody gets my newsletter. That's just the way the world is. You know, not everybody's going to get your newsletter. Not everybody reads your blog. That's okay. That's all right. I have all these different media, all these different... One way or another, I'm going to reach you. That's the point. I'm going to get my message out to you one way or another. But I have another interesting thing on entrepreneurship and opportunities online and how I want to teach entrepreneurship to my kids. It's a difficult thing because how do you teach entrepreneurship without sucking all the life out of entrepreneurship? And can you teach entrepreneurship to adults or to kids? It's something that it's good to know, and it's good to have entrepreneurial skills in the year 2015, 2016, and into the future, because I think just sitting in a classroom for 4 years because that's what everybody else is doing, there are benefits to that. I absolutely don't deny that, but I think that alone is not going to position you where you want to be. There are some people who have gotten away without going to college at all, and that can work for some people. There are others who go to get the piece of paper, but then who realize they're going to need entrepreneurial skills to cope in this kind of economy. So I do want my kids to pick this up, and I don't quite know how to do it. But anyway, I'm going to talk to you about in particular one thing that I just don't see the downside to, that I think a lot of people could try out. I think it's a good idea, and it's something that I would be trying out if I didn't have 800 other things I was already doing. Anyway, so two episodes in one. Let's start with the social contract. What I want to do is play for you, as I say, the audio of about 95% of a YouTube video that I did about 3.5 years ago on this subject, and then I'm going to supplement that with my commentary here in 2015. So here we go with what I had to say all those years ago.
Hey everybody, it's Tom Woods, August 7th, 2012. I just wanted to answer very briefly a common argument you get on the internet, from the man on the street, and so on, to the effect that if you libertarians don't like our system and you don't like the rules, and why don't you pack up and leave? You have implicitly agreed to abide by the rules, and so if you don't like them, you might as well scram and all that. Now, I don't think that's a particularly strong argument, but you get it a lot, so I wanted to take it on. Now, my first response, my instinctive response is, why should I leave? Why should I be the one who has to leave? Why is the moral burden on me when, in fact, you're the one with the gun? I'm the peaceful person. You're the one wielding a gun who wants to expropriate me and then use the proceeds to fund drone strikes. It would seem to me that a healthy moral reckoning would have it that you would have to demonstrate your right to do that before I would have to demonstrate my right to sit here unmolested. So that'd be the first point. But then also the idea that my mere presence somewhere indicates my consent to the system is highly problematic. And that is what they're saying. They're saying you're here after all, so you have to agree to the rules. Just by being here, you've automatically consented to the rules. That's clearly not the case. As my friend Roderick Long puts it, suppose your neighbor starts dumping garbage on your lawn. Does that, and you don't move away right away. You stay in that house. Does that mean, the fact that you're staying in the house and you don't immediately move, does that mean that you've consented to the garbage being dumped on your lawn and it should just continue to go on and that would be just? Well, obviously not. And now continuing with some arguments that Roderick has made, which I think are very helpful. He's a professor of philosophy at Auburn. When people talk about my agreeing to abide by the rules, well, the issue is, depends on the moral status and the legal status of the lawmaker. So, for example, suppose I have you over to my house, and you come in the door, and I say to you, you have to wear the funny hat. And this may seem odd to you, and I say, but you're in my house, these are the rules. Well, it's an odd rule, but you're in my house, I can make the rules. What you can't do is say, well, I'm going to stay in your house and not wear the funny hat. These are my rules. Now, on the other hand, suppose I come to your house, and I knock on your door, and when you come to the door, I say to you, you have to wear the funny hat. Well, then you would have every right in the world to say, now, wait a minute. When did I agree to wear the funny hat? You would not accept as an explanation, well, you know, you moved in next door to me, so that implicitly, you were implicitly giving your consent to wearing the hat. Even though right to my face, you are telling me you don't want to wear the hat, your implicit mystical consent by moving in the general area of my hat indicated that your consent to the funny hat system. No one would accept that. There's no part of our lives in which we would accept implicit, hypothetical, tacit sort of consent. We would never accept this. As usual, government has its own rules that it abides by, that no one else, no one in private life would agree to a system like that. So when people say to you, by being here, you have automatically consented to the rules, they're begging the whole question. They're assuming the very thing that's supposed to be proven. They're totally overlooking the distinction in the funny hat example between the guy who had the right to tell you to wear the funny hat, you could leave if you didn't want to, and the case in which he didn't have the right to tell you to wear the funny hat. It depends on, is he legitimately exercising jurisdiction? Well, over his own property, he is. But over your property, he isn't. Well, the you have automatically agreed to abide by the rules crowd just totally ignores the question of, is the lawgiver justly in power? Does he own this property? Did he properly come to exercise this power? None of these moral questions are even considered. They're all just simply ignored and glided over. Then we're told that we use the government systems. I drive on the roads, I use the post office or whatever. And so that means, therefore, I've consented to be expropriated and have the funds used for drone strikes. But here, again, this is a problem. The mere fact that I inescapably use systems that services that I have no choice but to use does not indicate consent, any more than the fact that I might eat a meal in prison indicates my consent to imprisonment. No, this whole argument of implicit consent, tacit consent, all this is all just a pathetic smokescreen to conceal the fact that my actual words and my actual views are in the form of dissent. And my actual words of, I don't consent to this, are supposed to be somehow overridden by this mystical tacit consent that I didn't even know I was engaging in by the mere fact of standing in some place. This is a ridiculous argument that's advanced by people who simply want to wield power. And then after the fact, they come up with this crummy rationalization to try to make it seem as if I really want to be ruled. I implicitly crave being ruled. I've implicitly consented to being ruled. I don't implicitly do any of this. I explicitly say, no, I do not consent to this.
All right, I think that's a decent overview of some of the problems with the idea of the social contract. But what I want to do now is add a few more. And in doing so, I want to talk about a couple of historical figures. And here I am very glad to make reference to an article that I will link to at tomwoods.com/545 by Williamson Evers, Bill Evers, all the way back from 1977. This is an article from the Journal of Libertarian Studies. As I've told you before, there are so many gems that have been forgotten sitting there in the Journal of Libertarian Studies, a great, great scholarly journal. And he has an article called Social Contract, A Critique. And what he does is he goes through a number of well-known political thinkers from the past who, in one way or another, touched on the idea of the social contract, and he critiques what they have to say about it. So he talks about Socrates, in particular, in Plato's dialogue, The Crito. Then he talks about Thomas Hobbes, John Locke, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, and Ayn Rand. And for each one of these thinkers, he finds holes in what they have to say. Now, I won't go through all the thinkers, because that would take away all the fun of reading Bill Evers' article for yourself at tomwoods.com/545, where it is conveniently linked. However, I do want to say a little something, certainly about Socrates and about John Locke, because I think these of those people, well, Ayn Rand, but she's in a different category because her arguments are quite different from theirs. A lot of people admire Socrates, or they admire John Locke, and I include myself in both of those. I admire both of these people, so I think that's what makes it more interesting to look more closely at what they had to say, to try to dig out the nuggets of unwisdom in them, because we all know about the wisdom. Let's dig out the unwisdom. In the Crito, Socrates is in prison awaiting his execution. He's been sentenced to death by an Athenian jury. And he's explaining why he does not resist. And in explaining why he does not resist, he has recourse to arguments that we would recognize as being classic social contract-style arguments. Now, ultimately, he's going to rest his claims on arguments other than social contract ones, but because we do find these in Socrates, it is worth teasing them out and saying something about them. He says that the government is, and this is an exact quote, more to be valued and higher and holier far than mother or father or any ancestor, and more to be regarded in the eyes of the gods and of men of understanding, also to be soothed and gently and reverently entreated when angry, even more than a father, and either to be persuaded or, if not persuaded, to be obeyed. And what he'll say is that really, without the services provided by the state, what kind of society could we really have? This is a society that has educated me, that creates laws by which we're able to enjoy a common life. And as so many thinkers do, he simply conflates society and the state. Or he assumes that desirable things have to come only from the state. Now, even if that were the case, you can't just assume it. You have to prove this. This is what a philosopher is supposed to do. He's not supposed. I mean, you look at any philosopher, you read any philosophy today, every word is extremely carefully defined and nothing is assumed and it's step by step. So you can't just leave this out and just automatically leap to, well, we need laws, so therefore the state. Or we need education, so therefore the state. That's just sloppy thinking. That leaves out a lot of steps. Now, as I say, you might believe that those steps can be supplied. The point is they're not being supplied here. Socrates also points to the possibility of free emigration. You can leave Athens freely. This is another of its great merits. So he's talking about all the ways in which Athenian society is valuable, and by extension, all the ways in which the Athenian state is valuable and to be obeyed. So if I were to disobey this institution, I would be spitting in the face of an institution that has done me personally so much good and has made possible this wonderful society. He also says that another merit of the Athenian state is its openness to reasoned participation by citizens in political decision-making. All right, so let's think about some of these. We get benefits from the Athenian state. Well, that's true, but I bet people got some benefits in Nazi Germany from the state. Does that mean that they were therefore obligated to obey the government of Nazi Germany or Stalinist Russia or any other government? So you see, this proves too much. This can't. If this means that I have to obey the greatest tyrants in the history of the world, then it's not much of a criterion at all, is it? Or what about openness to participation, right? In Athenian society, if I have the good fortune to be an Athenian citizen, which would make me a small minority of the Athenian population, I would have the ability to stand up and have my voice heard in the assembly. And I would have a very good chance of serving in government in one capacity or another because so many offices were chosen by lot. But is this enough to obligate me to the regime? That's the question. And as Evers says, if a burglar lets you argue with him while he's relieving you of your valuables, it does not place you under an obligation to him. So even if I'm allowed to stand there and explain to the burglar why, in my reasoned opinion, what he is doing to me is unjust, this doesn't mean that because of his good nature in letting me voice my opinion, I'm therefore obligated to obey him from now on. So Socrates uses the benefits argument to justify his claim that we are bound to the state in one way or another, that we've accepted this because we've accepted the state's benefits. That's a very common justification for the idea that I've accepted a social contract, that we've heard, I think I mentioned it in the video, and certainly I mentioned in the video the claim also made by Socrates that the right to emigrate is also morally relevant to the subject of the social contract, because if you can leave and you choose not to, then that proves you've consented to the system. If you're sticking around, then that proves you've consented. So, in other words, the burden of proof is on you to leave. So, Michael Humer says, if the mafia were to take over your town, really would the burden of proof be on you? Would the burden be on you to leave? Why would that be? Why would the moral priorities run in that direction? Well, Socrates even says in the Crito, he says, "He who has experience of the manner in which we order justice and administer the state and still remains has entered into an implied contract that he will do as we command him. And he who disobeys us is thrice wrong." And then he explains why you're wrong to disobey the state. So he even uses the term implied contract. Isn't that interesting? All the way back in ancient Athens, we see that term being used. And yet, ultimately, for Socrates, the contract idea is not the deciding one. Although he makes a lot of these common arguments, and a lot of what we've heard from Socrates right now is material that we hear from people in social media all the time. Very common. But ultimately, he rests his argument on simply that the Athenian state is a worthy institution, it's valuable, and it ought to be obeyed. And we ought to think of ourselves as being in a relationship of children to parents with regard to how we stand in relation to the state. So that's 5th century Athens, 5th century BC, obviously. But now let's say something about John Locke, who's writing in the late 17th century and who is correctly associated with the classical liberal tradition. Locke is, according to Murray Rothbard, Locke is one of these cases where the conventional wisdom is absolutely correct. The conventional wisdom holds Locke to be a propertarian classical liberal. And yeah, that's exactly what he is. And half the time, people get things wrong. They think people are libertarians when they're not, and so on. But clearly Locke is, even if he's not quite a Rothbardian. It is interesting, there's a guy, his name is John Simmons, if I remember this correct, who has a book, and it might be called On the Edge of Anarchy. It's about John Locke, and it's got the word anarchy in the title. And he says that if you really follow Locke's arguments, you forget about Locke's inconsistencies, but you follow the direction of Locke's arguments, it takes you into a kind of anarchism. So if you're interested in that, then and you want to drive your political philosophy professor crazy, read Simmons. If I have a good enough memory, I'll link to that book on the show notes page. Remember, tomwoods.com/545. Well, anyway, we've talked about Locke on this show before, and he does believe in individual rights, and he believes that governments are established in order to better protect individual rights than they could be protected in the absence of government. But he has limits on what government can do. He believes that people have the right to overthrow governments. But at the same time, he does believe that there is a kind of social contract that does bind you to the to what that government orders you to do. And he, so he even says that people must be understood when they form political society, they must be understood to give up all the power necessary to the ends for which they unite into society. And as it turns out, even Locke repeats the benefits argument of Socrates. Maybe he didn't get it from Socrates, but he repeats this benefits argument. If you're using the government's roads, can you believe even then roads were being thrown at us? Even then? Are we to be spared nothing? So using the roads or enjoying the protection of the government, or interestingly enough, holding real estate under government protection. In fact, as Evers points out, Locke's view is that if you are a landholder, the covenant, the social contract that you have with the government runs with your land. So if somebody inherits this land from you, that person also inherits the obligation to government. Now, when you look at how Locke justifies this, he justifies it all on the basis of, for instance, on the basis of expediency. He says it would be nice to be able to get the consent of every single individual to the government, but that would be impractical. I mean, for one thing, people are busy. For another thing, a lot of people are sick. So even if everybody did consent, it would be hard to get them all together to register their consent officially. So it's legitimate to go ahead and act as if everybody has consented. Well, all right, but then maybe Locke shouldn't be arguing from consent. He should be arguing from expediency. He should be arguing from majority rule. But if he's coming right out and saying, well, there's no way we can get everybody's consent, then maybe he ought to chuck the idea of consent or just be more honest about it. Then he talks about the desirability of government as a common judge of disputes and that some people recognize this. He says, now, if people who want to establish the state for the sake of protecting their individual rights were not able to include minorities under their control. In other words, if the majority of people, he takes the majority of people as consenting to the state because they perceive its benefits, if they weren't able to enforce the laws on the dissenters, then the state would be in vain. You'd have people running around who not subject to it who could presumably, you know, get away with all kinds of enormities. Well, whether that's true or it isn't, it has absolutely nothing to do with consent, which is supposed to be the basis of his argument, that the legitimacy of government is based on the consent of the governed. But then when it comes down to it, and he admits, well, we don't really have the consent of the governed, he says, well, that's okay, because how could the government work if we had to get the consent of everybody? Well, all right, well, then don't make your argument based on consent to start with. Make some other kind of argument. Anyway, check out this article by Evers. It's a pretty good distillation of what major thinkers thought about the social contract problem. But as you can see, just when you just take a quick glance at it, it's got real problems. It's got weaknesses. And you may say, but okay, we need some kind of implicit agreement among ourselves, don't we? We need this or that. And then, of course, there's the assumption. There are a lot of assumptions baked into this. The idea that only the state can provide certain services, or because we all need to have an impartial, an impartial judge. Well, why does that mean we all need to have the same impartial judge? All of these are unanswered questions. Now, you may say, but there are good answers to those questions. All right, but you got to make them. You can't just act as if they're not there, because they are there. All right, so that's it for part one of the episode. Second part is going to be a lot shorter. But it's just some things that have been on my mind lately because it's what I'm really interested in these days and it's what I've been writing about. I think I've told you that I've been writing an ebook. It is finished. We're just laying it out. I'm actually having this one laid out really nicely and professionally, so it'll be really easy on the eyes. You know, I'm shelling out a bit for this free ebook. You know, free for you. Free for you, not for me. But it's okay because I'm really happy with it. What I did was, it's called Five Paths to an Online Income. So what I've done is I've done a chapter on podcasting. How do you start a podcast step by step? And is it possible to be compensated for the time and effort that goes into producing it? If so, what form would that compensation take? So I talk about that. I talk about, let's see, freelancing online. This is a, you know, the internet is a freelancer's dream, for heaven's sake. So I talk about that. I talk about how to self-publish a book. I know there are people who are interested in that, and I now have experience in that. I've published ebooks. I've published, I self-published a print book, Real Descent, last year, and I know the ins and outs of it now. I know exactly what to do and where to go and whose help you need and what you don't need. And so, in other words, these are all ways that somebody can legitimately earn money online. Not one of them is a get-rich-quick scheme. Not one. Each one is going to take some work. But it helps if somebody who's done them writes down the steps for you. And that's exactly what I've done in this forthcoming ebook. So I will announce that to you when it is ready. And it will be ready sometime this month, December 2015. So just listen for that, and I will tell you about it. Now, let's see. For example, one of the things you can do is to be a freelancer. And it doesn't even have to be something that is your main area. It can just be a way to earn extra money. So, for instance, you can be a transcriptionist and transcribe, for example, podcast episodes. There are a lot of people looking for that service. You can get good at that quickly, and you can advertise your services on a place like Fiverr, Fiverr with two R's. If you haven't checked out Fiverr yet, I cannot recommend it highly enough. Fiverr, they call it Fiverr because everything you do there is done in $5 increments. So you're able to get a lot of inexpensive services. I've gotten, like, the book cover for my 14 Hard Questions for Libertarians book cost me $5. I got it from Fiverr. It's perfectly sleek and it's perfectly serviceable for a free ebook. And in fact, I was so pleased with it that I sent the guy a tip. I felt guilty getting this book cover for just $5. And then you can upsell people. You can say, well, if you want something more than my basic plan, you get the super deluxe one, that'll be an extra $20. But it starts off at $5. There are all kinds of services that you have the ability to provide that you can provide on Fiverr. So it's very much worth checking out. And then you think to yourself, but Woods, I don't really have any skills. All right, now hold on a minute. In my ebook, I'm going to actually be linking to a video of a video that I did from when my wife and I were about to celebrate Christmas of 2013. It's a video of all the Fiverr gigs that I bought for her, showing people wishing her a Merry Christmas. These are people who earn money on Fiverr by dressing up like a barbarian and saying your 30-second message. Or I had a guy who had giant eyes that popped out of his head, and for $5, he would say something. I had a guy who rode a unicycle. He was riding a unicycle holding a sign saying, Merry Christmas, Heather. I had a guy halfway around the world in a loincloth who was holding a watermelon. And in the video, he's eating through the green outer part of the watermelon, just gouging it, eating through it, until finally in the middle there's a message, and he pulls it out, and of course it's Merry Christmas, Heather. I had somebody set up a row of dominoes, and when the dominoes collapsed, it pulled down a sign saying Merry Christmas. I mean, these people are earning money doing this. In fact, one of my kids became entrepreneurial enough that a couple of years ago, because I was finding all these things with my kids at the computer, saying, oh, why don't we get this for Mom? This would be funny. And they had this thing where they would go down the stairs together on a blanket and just yell and scream and have fun. And one of them said, well, what if we went down the stairs on our blanket holding somebody's sign? So holding somebody's corporate logo or whatever. I thought, all right, that's my kid. So anyway, I have a 12-year-old. We have five girls. And I have a 12-year-old who, you know, is starting to have some entrepreneurial instincts. And I really want to help encourage them. And yet I don't want to tell her what to do because that would suck all the life out of entrepreneurship. I don't know exactly what to tell her to do, you know? So I just give her advice and I encourage her and I give suggestions. But of course, I don't want to do it for her. I want her to try things out for herself. Now, she's only 12, so I do have a really good freelance idea. And if she were 15 or older, maybe 16 or older, I would actually try and do this with her. And this is, let me tell you up front, I'm an affiliate of Zappable. But I love this thing because, as I said in my newsletter, I have an audio engineer now for the show because of you generous people who support the show or make your product, make your Amazon purchases through tomwoods.com/Amazon, I'm able to have an audio engineer, and that frees up a lot of extra time. I wouldn't have been able to write this free ebook if I'd had to be doing all the audio engineering myself. Well, anyway, I have an audio editor, but on occasions when he's sick or, you know, I'm doing the episode myself, then I can, you know, without a guest, and I don't really need him as much for those episodes, I can do the audio editing myself. Now, I'm a complete imbecile when it comes to, what do I know about audio editing? But thanks to the miracle of the market, I can get a free program called Audacity that you can download for nothing, and it makes audio editing easy for even an idiot like me. And I don't use 99% of the features. I have no idea what they do. Don't even care what they do. Don't need them. Well, likewise, there's this brand new product called Zappable. It's not brand new. That's they're relaunching it with super-duper features added to it. The idea of Zappable, tomwoods.com/zap is the link, is that it can create mobile apps very easily, point and click, drag and drop. It's easy to make an app for your business with this thing. You don't have to pay $1 zillion to an app developer. You can have all the features you could possibly imagine. So a restaurant could not only have, you know, map with directions and a menu, but also take reservations online, be able to do takeout orders through the app. These sorts of things that would make a local non-franchise restaurant really stand out, or a bar that could send out a text to everybody who has the app saying, hey, it's an impromptu 2-for-1 night. Well, if you got that as you were driving around, you'd go to that bar. So it's a tremendous asset, but most local businesses don't think they can have an app. They'd love to, but they think they have to be like a Fortune 500 company to afford one. But that's not true. So Zappable is a thing that what I would do if my daughter were a little older is I would say to her, let's you and me go into business together in a little side business, and we will create mobile apps for businesses here in Topeka. Now, it's true we would be competing against app development companies out there. That's true. But you know how many of these app development companies a local business in Topeka has ever heard of? You can count it on no hand whatsoever. You know how many of those app development companies are going to go to a local business in your town, door to door, and say, hey, here's an app? Zero. So you have an advantage if you actually take initiative. Most people don't. Most people do not take initiative. It's inertia overtakes them. Now, what I would do is I would not follow their advice and go to businesses and say, hey, would you like an app? No. Because Zappable is so easy to use, I would design the app and then bring it into them and say, how would you like this? Would you like this? You see the benefits that this would bring to your company? How much this would make you stand out in this area? How would you like this? And then I would make a deal with them. And you can do pretty well with mobile apps. You have a monthly maintenance fee that you charge, and you have a front-end payment for the app itself. Again, the features on this thing are absolutely amazing, and like Audacity, which helps me to become an audio editor even though I'm an idiot, Zappable allows me to create apps. I mean, there are so many things like this out there that people just don't know about. Now, especially if I were young, if I were a student, I would do something like this. Because everybody thinks young people are technological whizzes, which many of them are. So if I were smartly, I would be smartly dressed, and I would walk in confidently with my professional folder and my mobile device to demonstrate what I've produced. I would produce it, as I say, on spec. No guarantee they're going to take it, but I would bring it in there and say, "This is what I can do for you." And if they don't like it, that's okay. I go to one of their competitors and I rebrand it with the competitor logo. And I bet you that first one will be upset they didn't take my app. So this is one of the things that when I saw it, I said, that is an instant side business idea. And I would do it I would want to go into business with my daughter to show her that in 2015, you don't just sit around waiting for somebody to hire you. You make opportunities for yourself. And this would give her confidence. It would give her a sense of accomplishment. She'd acquire a marketable skill. She'd understand entrepreneurship better. And she'd have a leg up on her peers. Anyway, that's my idea. Steal it if you like. But please steal this idea. That's the subtitle of this episode, Steal This Idea. And if you check it out through tomwoods.com/zap, you will find a video demonstration of how it works, and you'll see how easy it is. And this is, to me, this is one of the miracles of the market, that you get these products that make it possible for ordinary people to do amazing things. The fact that I produce a podcast every day is absolutely amazing. But because we live in a society of miracles, we don't pause to appreciate these things. Unless you're a listener of this show, if you're like me, you think about this all the time. Like, this is amazing. I can't believe I get to live in this kind of world. So anyway, tomwoods.com/zap. At least have a look at it. Maybe this is something for you, maybe not. But certainly it's a great example of how the innovation of the market opens up opportunities for people, opportunities they would never have thought of on their own or anticipated on their own. So, all right, I think that's all I have to say. I'll put that up also at tomwoods.com/545. Thanks so much for listening. See you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.